We Made This.
Hey everyone, this is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or you're just about to listen to. We'd love to keep the lights on a bit longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights on the website and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. So just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis. To get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey Bell. I used to write for The X-Files, and you're listening to The X-Cast.
And welcome along to our continuing coverage of Season 7 of The X-Files. Joining me is a returning guest who I've had on the Time Is Now podcast, the Millennium podcast, over on the sister show to this show, and that's Michael J. Petty. Michael, how are you doing, mate?
I'm good, Kurt. How are you doing?
Very hot is the word. I've done a lot of recordings this week, and Orison was one of them with Darren Mooney, who you had the pleasure of talking about somehow saying got behind me recently over on Times Now. And I said to him, I said, to quote an X-File movie, what we're doing out here is hotter than hell. So that's how I'm feeling right now. It's now 32 degrees and we haven't even started.
Oh, no.
So this is going to be a fun one to talk, especially with, like, there's lots of rain and lightning storms in this episode. Yeah, so, Michael, you've been on the X-Cast before. You've done a round table a long, long time ago.
A long time ago, yes.
Okay, so this is your first episode on the main show, which does mean that we have to do the five questions of X, which we shall do for you right now.
I'm here for it.
Excellent. Okay, so the first question that we have is, when did you first discover the X-Files?
So I'm kind of a late bloomer as far as the original run of the show. I first discovered the X-Files probably around 2000, 2001, maybe 2002 at the latest. I was born in 1995, so I was born while the show was actually going on, and my parents watched it when they were first married. And so when the DVDs started coming out, specifically the Mythology DVDs, dad got a hold of those and started watching those, that and the movie. I watched the movie so many times as a kid, it freaked the hell out of me. Holy crap. That alien in the tunnels, I could not handle it. So I just grew up watching the whole myth arc of the show. I didn't really watch a ton of the Monster of the Week episodes because we just didn't have them on DVD. But I loved Mulder and Scully. I love the Mythology. I love the alien stuff. As much as it freaked me out, I couldn't stop watching. And so I was hooked super, super early in my childhood, probably somewhere between 5 and 7 years old.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so super young.
I mean, bear in mind, I was in 93, 94 when it came out, maybe 95 here. I would have been 15, you know, so it was 15, 16 when I started to get properly into it, I would say. So being that young, you know, and as I say, with some of the stuff that's in there. So since this is just a secondary question then, based on what you've just said there. So since then, I still stick to the fact that I enjoy the Mythology more. I am a dying breed in that. Have you reassessed it? Have you looked at, do you think Monster of the Week shines through more now on reflection? Or do you still think that the Mythology is particularly your favorite kind of thing with the X-Files?
Yeah, I think the Monster of the Week stuff kind of shines through more in some ways. The myth arc is actually my favorite part of the X-Files still. I'm kind of like you in that regard, but going back and rewatching episodes that I had never seen as a kid and just rediscovering a lot of that, especially in this era of TV that we're in where it's all myth arcs and it's all self-contained stories and all that. None of it is Monster of the Week stuff anymore. Not really, not the big stuff anyway. And so you have Stranger Things, which is a whole season story, and you don't really get these one-off episodes in shows now. And I love that. I still love that. My favorite show of all time is Smallville, and most of Smallville is Freak of the Week episodes is what they call it. And I love that. I think that's a lot of fun, and I think there's a lot of room for character growth and development and to say something that you might not be able to say in a myth arc. So my favorite episode is actually a Monster of the Week episode, but my favorite part of the X-Files is the myth arc.
Right. Yeah. I would say that, you know, mine's a mix because obviously Jose Chung's From Outer Space is my favorite episode. Sure. So mine's a bit of a mix of both, really. So just on that, actually, because in the Twitter sphere, I don't know if you've seen it. I know that you're on Twitter, but not on too much. But there was a recent review, or I wouldn't like to quote who it was because I don't know. But they were talking about that they were watching the X-Files and they classed some of the Monster of the Weeks as filler episodes. And I found that really fascinating because filler, for me, would be part of a myth arc or things like on Lost, for example, where there'd be episodes was like, well, what does that really mean to the whole story? And X-Files didn't really work in that way. So I found it really interesting that someone would review the X-Files in that way, saying, oh, this is a filler episode. I can understand it to a degree for a 24, 25 episode season where you might get some episodes that are not as good and because they've got a lot to get through. But I wouldn't necessarily class anything as a filler. I mean, I don't know what you feel on that.
Definitely not within the original run of the show. I don't think so at all. And even the reboot stuff, I wouldn't necessarily classify anything as filler. Maybe more so than some of the original episodes. Yeah. But no, I would disagree with that. I think there's still, like we were saying, a lot of room for good character growth and development and honestly just exciting and interesting stories.
Yeah.
I wouldn't classify that as filler. I think that's mischaracterization.
Yeah, and I think there is arguments. I mean, I don't know if you've been watching Loki recently or even mentioned Stranger Things, where they'll have one episode which is completely outside of the main plot. Like, I know the Stranger Things did that. Recently went into the city, didn't they? So, so I can see where it's come from. It's just really viewing the X-Files in that kind of mold of, you know, post-2020s or even like post-2015 or something, that it's not really, I wouldn't really class it. I think X-Files was too early to be able to class it as that.
And I also don't think you can do that with older TV.
No.
You know, do you know what I mean? Anything before the 2010s, I don't think you can. And I think that's being generous. I think you'd probably have to go even further to like 2015, 2016. But anything before that, you can't necessarily classify just random episodes of a show as filler because they all mean something. My wife and I have been rewatching Little House on the Prairie, the old show. And just about every one of those episodes is a filler episode if you classify it in that context, but it's not. They all mean something. There's always this lesson. There's always some character growth or development. And I think we see that even in episodes like Signs of Wonders, which obviously we'll get to, but there's elements of Scully's faith, which is a part of the entire show and her arc on the entire show. There's always something.
I mean, I would argue there is potentially filler in Lost. There's a couple of episodes which which was 2004. So that's what I would argue. But let's move on to the second question. And you've mentioned that you're going to pick a Monster of the Week episode, but what would your favorite episode be then?
My favorite episode of the X-Files is actually Dihan Diverlets.
All right. Okay.
That's actually my favorite episode of the show. I think there's a lot of really interesting spiritual and religious themes to that. I think the satanic ritual abuse plotline is really fascinating. And it's an episode that actually feels very millennium to me, which is, I think, why I love it so much and why I was drawn to millennium in the first place is a lot of those themes. So,
yeah, as I say, Darren and I spoke on Orison. And we were talking that, you know, it's strange that you get the Millennium episode in season 7 is written by Frank Spotnitz, who didn't do a Millennium episode. Then you get Chip Johannesson doing an Orison, who, you know, and then the fact that Orison is almost bookended with Irresistible. But we even said, you know, we'll take that as the mainstay. But in conversations we've had recently, we've said that's actually probably before that, you know, as I say, as you say, season two of X-Files would definitely have those kind of themes and stuff that's got kind of percolating through Chris Carter's mind, I think, at that point. And I think that's probably De Hand of the Valette is definitely an interesting one. What about favorite season then? Do you think season two, being that you do have the darker themes, or have you picked another season?
I do really love season two. That would probably be my favorite season. I think I also have an unpopular opinion in that I really like seasons five and six, because I really like Mulder's arc going through doubt and then becoming a believer again.
Right.
I think that's probably one of the most interesting parts of the whole show for me.
Right.
And so those seasons have a very special place in my heart, especially because it's surrounding the first film.
Yeah.
And the first film played such a huge part in my childhood. So.
Okay. Favorite moment. This moment, this could be 20 seconds. It could be like a full scene. So what would you class to be your favorite moment in the show?
Favorite moment. That putting me on the spot. Jeez.
It's a hard one, I know.
That is a hard one. Mulder has this. What's that episode with the freak show?
A humbug.
That one, yes. Yeah. Where Scully is interviewing a guy and they're talking about Mulder and they look over and he's just sitting there posed. Yeah. They're standing there posed.
Yeah.
I really love that. That's just classic Mulder to me.
Right.
There's also this line, and I can't remember the episode. I'm sorry. I'm horrible with episode titles, but there's this line where Mulder says, well, you know, it's just your classic case of demon fetal harvestation.
Yeah.
I love that line too. I don't remember what episode that's from, but that's a favorite moment of mine. I use that line a lot in real life.
It's classic. I'm pretty sure it's Terms of Endearment. And finally, your final question is, who would you consider to be your favorite character? It could be Mulder, it could be Scully, it could be Frank Black, it could be, you know, Toombs, it could be absolutely anyone.
Well, I mean, I have to go with Mulder. I just, you know, I love the believer. I love his quest for the truth. I have very much resonated with that in my own personal life. I think I would definitely go with Mulder. The show just wasn't the same without him around.
No, I really like season eight. I find it amazing season. But you're right. My favorite character is Mulder. But I don't have such a cling hold onto the show itself without him. Yes, there's a big part missing, and I think it's more pronounced in season nine. Yeah. But I think season eight needed that boost. This is why I think season seven for me is an interesting season, because it's bookended. Like you say, season six, I really, really enjoy season six for different reasons. It's exactly the same as what you're saying with the film. You've got a really good season in season six. Then you've got season seven, which feels tired. And it's, Darren's mentioned about this zombification of the season. It seems to be everything's about zombies. I've noted this perception of time gets slowed down, and it does it again in this episode. And I'm finding that more and more, that there's this idea of time slowing down, that they're slowly getting to the end kind of thing. And then you get the rejuvenation of season eight with the fact that Mulder's gone, and you've got that whole aspect. And I think season seven for me has fallen by the wayside, but it's certainly been interesting going through, especially this early part of the season, to see where I land. And so far, you know, I'm actually really enjoying this reevaluation, so it's really good.
It definitely has its moments.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's brilliant episodes in season seven. I wouldn't necessarily say, you know, it's been a bad season, because I wouldn't ever say that about any, including season nine. I still think there's some really good stuff in season nine.
I agree.
But, you know, so you do have things like, for me, X-Cops and Just Sweats and, you know, Zion's Light and Closure. There's lots of great, great stuff in this. Ironically, Millennium isn't one of them, which I don't know if you agree, but I enjoy it, but it's not Millennium and it's not the X-Files, put it that way. So what do you actually think to the Millennium episode? Do you think it served either show at all, or do you think it was had its issues?
You know, I've always felt that the Millennium episode of the X-Files felt more like the X-Files than it did Millennium.
Yeah.
I've always felt it was more about Mulder and Scully kind of walking into Frank Black's world rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
Or I'm sorry. I meant that opposite. I felt like it was Frank Black walking into Mulder and Scully's world more like the other way around. Yeah. It just never felt fully Millennium to me, which is interesting because there are episodes of this season even, and I think we're talking about, we're going to be talking about one today,
yeah,
that feel more Millennium-ish.
Yeah.
Than the Millennium episode did. And I think that's a really interesting concept. I think the problem with the episode is that they try so hard, I think, to get to those final moments between Mulder and Scully, and they yeah. don't actually do their due diligence with Frank and Jordan.
No.
And I think that is the problem. I like it. I think it's fun. I don't mind it. It's nice to see Frank again. It's even cool to see him interact with Mulder and Scully. But the season three finale of Millennium, it just feels more like a better end to the show.
Yeah.
For me. And that in the comic as well. I think the comic does a phenomenal job. The miniseries that Joe okay. Harris wrote. So
yeah. Yeah. We actually, Kathy Glinsky was talking to me about this. She's listened to the Millennium episode and said that I asked the question, did Millennium end well on the third season? Because did it really need this episode? Sure. And that's kind of the sort of thing I said. He says, well, not really. And the best way I described it was, it's like you're leaving the X-Files with existence. You know, the fact that you're leaving Mulder and Scully and the baby a lot together, and then you kind of pull them away, and then you leave them to the B. And that could be quite a good finale for the show. And that's mm-hmm. how I felt with Millennium Season 3's ending. It kind of leaves you in a good place. And yeah. there wasn't any need to do the Millennium show, apart from the fact we hadn't reached 2000. So just explain that to someone who's seen most of the first season, bit of the second, but she just wanted to know that. So that was just really interesting.
Yeah, it's a fun epilogue, but it's not necessary.
Yeah, yeah, I'd say that. Yeah, definitely. Right, okay, let's dive into the main reason why we're here. We're talking about, as I say, Signs and Wonders, which was written by Jeffrey Bell and directed by Kim Manners. It's season 7, episode 9, originally aired on the 23rd of January 2000. Before we talk about in general, what would you rate this out of 10? And what are your general thoughts on this episode in particular?
You know, I think I'd give this episode a solid 7. I think it's a solid episode. It doesn't stand out to me in terms of the whole X-Files canon or chronology, right. but it is solid when you go back and rewatch it. There's some really interesting twists and turns and some unexpected stuff that happens. I realized when I've watched this episode twice in preparation for today.
Yeah.
And I realized during the first watch that it actually, I think, was my first time watching it.
All right. Okay.
I think it was just one of those episodes that somehow I missed.
Right.
And I just never got back to it. And I was like, I don't remember any of this. So whether it was or wasn't, it felt like my first time rewatching it. And so all of the twists and turns were very exciting for me. I really appreciated that. And so, yeah, I think that this episode has a lot of really interesting themes and ideas and is an interesting commentary on religion that I'm sure we'll get into a little bit as this continues. But yeah, I think it's solid. I don't think it's X-Cops or some of the other better episodes of the yeah. season, but I do think it's good.
Yeah. I'm not that far behind you, if I'm being absolutely honest with you. I think I may have seen this episode, excluding the two times that I've just watched it today, probably no more than 3 times. I don't think I've watched this episode very much at all, if I'm being honest, mm-hmm. absolutely honest with you. But having said that, I would echo pretty much what you're saying. I think, actually, I quite enjoyed it. And I think I'll provide this with, I think with rewatching Millennium and watching that and going through that in depth helps yeah. because it comes out the back end of that. And I can see where, like you say, I can see where some of the hangover of Millennium finishing and X-Files picking up some of these pieces, like, as I say, like Gorison, like the Millennium episode, like mm-hmm. This one. So I find it fascinating from that point of view that it is an interesting one. And I can completely imagine, as my general thoughts, I could completely imagine sticking Frank Black in this, and you would yes. still, and you wouldn't necessarily need Mulder and Scully. Now that is in the mailbag, and also a criticism that I've heard quite a lot is that Mulder and Scully don't do much really, and I can get that. Does feel more like a Frank Black with Western kind of episode where mm-hmm. he would come in, maybe see what happens. Evil's almost untouchable. But then you get the story through other people. So yeah. So I do feel that there is an element to that, and I think that it could be quite an interesting Millennium episode. I would say probably about the same. I think 7 out of 10, it's solid. I remembered the twist, so I can't say that I didn't. So I kind of remember the very end scene as well. So I do remember that. But it is an interesting episode. IMDb score it 6.7 out of 10, which puts it in the bottom three episodes of the season. Do you think it's worthy of the bottom three? Have you rewatched season 7 recently? Is that an unfair question for you at the moment?
You know, I'm actually currently rewatching season 7.
Right. Okay.
And I don't think it's totally fair. I think there's worse episodes. I think as strong as the finale is, there's parts of it that I'm like, did we need to go there? Like with the very end, and of course, the show will cover that later. But I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that. I think it's probably right in the middle.
Yeah, it feels to me like that. But then when I look at season 7 in a whole, there isn't actually. Like, for example, Hungry gets an 8.1. And I'm not sure, me personally, whether or not I like that episode or not. I haven't rewatched that recently, but I'm not sure if I'd place this. I'd place this above Hungry for me. Millennium, I think I've gone on record. I think I said 6.5 out of 10. So that would be, it'd be above that as well. So,
sure.
So, yeah. So I think, I would say bottom third, but. Definitely not in the bottom three for me.
I think that's fair.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So let's talk about some of the behind the scenes things first. So first of all, we have a lot of snakes, and apparently, just to my quick check on Wikipedia, was that they actually did the casting by actually having live snakes there to make sure that people weren't particularly scared. Of them. David Duchovny is petrified of snakes. Kim Manners is petrified of snakes. So that was, something to behold. The fact that David Duchovny had to have a stunt double. And I think they use an arm from Dreamland for some of the scenes just to keep him away. So that's really interesting.
You know, that's really interesting about Kim Manners too, because it's not his first X-File that involves snakes.
No, what was the other one?
Diane Diverletz.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
his actually first directed episode of The X-Files.
Right. So, yeah, so he's got a fascination with his own fears then.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And also they were just saying as well that they had a hell of a lot of, safety meetings, even to the point of, where's the nearest hospital in case anyone did get bit. And it actually says here that to prevent future accidents, the mouths of the snakes were sealed with sutures, which I thought was quite
interesting.
I don't know. Would you be able to get away with that now? Is that animal cruelty or not? I don't know. So, yeah. So we'll leave it there because I'm not entirely sure, if I'm being honest with you.
I can't do snakes. Snakes freak me out. That opening scene terrifies me.
Well, let's go there then. Let's go to the opening scene. For me, it has ramifications of like classic openings, like Home, for example. It recalls that quite significantly for me. I think it's really well done, especially being in where it's based, where it's been filmed, that you do have, and I think this will come up a bit, is like that season 2 aesthetic that it kind of tries to push that Diane Diverletz kind of thing. As your first viewing of it that you can recall, how did you think that for that opening scene worked?
I thought it was great. I think the use of little to no dialogue was excellent. I think that really helped emphasize the horror and the fear. And I think the actor, because you said he was actually afraid of snakes. Is that right?
I don't know if that actor was. What they did was they went to cast as the people they went to cast actually brought in live snakes to check that they weren't afraid of snakes. So I think he would have been fine. It was more the people who were already part of the crew that were more scared.
Well, he did a great job because I bought it. I fully bought it. I think it works really well. I think him going for his gun and randomly shooting and nothing happening, I think that's terrifying. I think the snakes coming out of every nook and cranny of the car and surrounding him and hissing and rattling, and it really gets you. And if you don't like snakes, if you're like Indiana Jones or like me and you just can't deal with it, that freaks you out. That makes you not want to, that makes you look around at the couch around you and make sure that there are no snakes.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I think I'm not scared of snakes, but I'm not also not scared of birds either. But if I had six or seven of them flapping around me, or six or seven snakes around me, I think I still would have that fear. So I think it's really good primal fear that, you know, the X-Files obviously has used quite well here. I also think something that I never really thought of until this watch is that how ineffectual a gun would be, because they're kind of like, you know, you'd have to be spot on to get them on the head for a start off. You know, you're not shooting at a big body of anything like a dog or anything like that at all. So I find that, you know, the very fact that he's got that gun and it's not effective, I think works really well in the teaser as well.
Yep, and there's so many. And I think that kind of foreshadows later when Mulder and Scully are surrounded and they have their guns out and you're like, it's not going to do anything. Like, you know they're powerless, just like they know they're powerless.
Yeah, absolutely. We get to Mulder's office after the opening credits roll in, and Mulder's kind of trying to find the information out, and Scully's sort of, it's a very classic X-File, you know, in that way that, it's not something that they do that often nowadays, and it's kind of nice and refreshing when you do see them back in the office and doing the very thing that they do. There has been, and including on the X-Files basement, some criticism of Mulder and Scully, or David and Gillian, dialing it in from an acting perspective. Did you get that at all on this episode? Because I personally didn't to any major degree. I thought they just didn't have enough of things in the script to actually have a go at, really.
I fully agree with that.
Yeah, so it's I didn't really see anything that would be bad, you know, that would take me out at all. Maybe it is a little bit dry, but that's the way Mulder can be anyway. And I think taking stock of where he's been and where he is now, that, you know, the mythology's kind of wrapped up. He's got, you know, they've had the episode of Rush, which ironically they were talking about Smallville. With Rush being a very kind of small village kind of thing. That Mulder is in a bit more meditative way at the moment anyway. You know, you talk about season 5 and 6 and how he's finding his belief, but he is very kind of more meditative. And we would always have to say that there is this lawsuit that's hanging around the back of Chris Carter and David Duchovny at this point. So they had, obviously, did have stressful discussions. And I think the rest of the X-Cast crew talked about that on Sixth Extinction, just how that kind of, you know, the way that story was written, it was kind of like Chris Carter did his bit and David Duchovny wrote his bit, and they were in the same room together and things. So I can see that there may be some element to it, but it's I don't think it affected this episode personally from my perspective anyway.
No, I don't think Mulder feels any less like Mulder, and I feel the same about Scully. So.
Yeah. When we get to the church, you mentioned humbug before. The timing's really interesting here because they're at the funeral. Mulder's wearing, Mulder and Scully both on this episode particularly are wearing some interesting clothing choices. Yep. I noticed that he's wearing like a dark gray shirt here. And then we wear that bright white one later on in the episode. But they apologize for the timing because they've just finished the funeral. And, you know, and this is where we meet Reverend Mackey. You mentioned that there's some interesting twists here. So what did you make to Reverend Mackey on his first appearance here, and how religion is kind of portrayed in, because this is a very formalized version of a funeral, isn't it, really? It's very straightforward. It's, you know, what you'd expect to see on screen. How do you think that was portrayed with, especially moving into the later scenes when we move into the Signs and Wonders Church? It's the dichotomy of them both. It's really interesting. We'll get into that in a second.
Sure. I feel like Mackey's church is very traditional. It's very familiar. It's not something that is out of the ordinary. They don't they're not actively fundamentalists from the standpoint that they're picketing abortion clinics or screaming at people who disagree with them or whatever it is. It's very tolerant. And Mackey even says that he wants his church to be a tolerant church. And I think in a lot of ways, a lot of the church, at least here in America, I think is that way.
Right.
I think there's a lot of gentleness and just humility that comes off of him in these opening scenes. And that's very interesting given the end, obviously,
yeah.
But that's what you see at the beginning. And I think it works. I think it makes sense. It feels like any other pastor or priest or any other religious figure that you've seen come and go on this show or even Millennium before, who just kind of come in and they do their spiel and they leave and they feel like, yeah, that's a man of God. That makes sense. Like, it makes sense that he is this way and that he comforts people this way and that he's willing to help the authorities when necessary. So yeah. That's kind of the impression you get from him, I think.
Yeah. And I think, as you say, in X-Files, in Millennium, in any major TV show, that this would be the traditional way to showcase like this. And you wouldn't bat an eyelid with it. And I think the point being specifically for this episode is that, you know, you wouldn't expect the twist towards the end.
Exactly.
It's really interesting how they go from that to X-Files is over the last couple of seasons has really focused on the suburbia. And Millennium did the same as well, especially in season one, you know, with, you know, this perception of suburbia and higher living and things.
Yeah.
And if you take what we've got here with the church, Mackey's church, and then you could almost portray that as that's exactly what you expect, you know, that you've got the, I think the illusion being that, you know, when we get into the Signs and Wonders Church, that he starts saying about hot and cold, you don't want to be lukewarm, which I'm sure you'll have some comments on. That the Maud even says here, as a sign of faith, worshippers handle deadly snakes or drink poison to show their belief. And you know, it's very overt, it's very straightforward, it's very, this is what we do. But also the way that they portray it, there's no lights in the actual church. It seems to be a rundown area. They obviously, a lot of poorer people are there. It's kind of like an underbelly of sorts as well.
Sure.
And just creating that dichotomy between the two churches, I think is really, really interesting. And there is allusions to Mulder saying later on in the episode about, you know, the fact of tolerance, which we'll get to. But having that dichotomy, you know, and almost pointing you in that direction, but doing it in a way that it doesn't throw you off. It doesn't make you think, oh, well, these are obviously the good guys, because it actually has a really good effect on that point of view. But what do you make to that dichotomy then, the differences between the two of them and what Signs and Wonders God, Signs and Wonders Church stands for and how they do it?
Sure. I actually really like the dichotomy. I think it's really interesting. I think it's something that you don't really see a lot of in TV. Maybe sometimes in film, but I don't think a whole lot in TV. I think people just kind of shy away from some of those more extreme branches and, yeah, and comparing and juxtaposing them. But I really like it. I think this idea that the Signs and Wonders Church is run down and it's poor people, I don't think it's necessarily because they couldn't afford to have something else. I think in their mind, it's more this idea that, well, the church is a people, it's not a building.
Right.
Whereas in the other church, Mackey's church, it's very much the building is the church and the people are kind of inconsequential, as we see him picking and choosing them for extinction, essentially. And I think that's really interesting. I think there's a lot of subliminal stuff that's going on there that you might not otherwise pick up on.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you're good, Karim.
I was also going to say, I think the idea of snake handling, because this is very Appalachia, right? This is very much where we're at. And that's kind of what you see with the Signs and Wonders Church. This is very much like West Virginia in the heart of it, sort of idea.
Yeah.
And or the South, anywhere in the South, really. West Virginia, I'm just picking on them, I guess. but it's interesting, snake handling, because it's a practice that like didn't exist until the late 1800s. It's not something that the early church did. It's not something that is even necessarily commanded in the Bible. It's something that people did to show their faith. And it was actually created by a guy named George Hensley, who actually died by a snake bite later on in his ministry. He actually died because of this in the 1950s. And they take passages like Mark 16 or Luke 10 or even Acts 28, which all talk about Jesus giving his disciples and his apostles and his followers in general power over scorpions and snakes and nothing will harm you and that sort of thing. They take that very literally instead of in a figurative sense or in a sense that says, no, I'm giving you power like over demonic powers. In their mind, it's like, no, I'm giving. He gave us power over all of it. So we should be able to handle snakes and be OK. And right. It's a very, very, very fundamentalist way of looking at it, which is why I like that they use that word, because it's a very literal translation of what they mean. And then when you see them doing their Bible studies or, you know what I'm, their services where they're talking about Revelation 3:16, you see both of them talking about God spewing the lukewarm out of his mouth. And it's very different the way that they talk about that. You know, in the more charismatic type church, the fundamentalist church, you have them. It's fire and brimstone. This is a problem. And we should not be this way, and we need to do something about it. And it's not necessarily bad, it's just harsh.
Right.
Whereas you look at Mackey's church, and it's very kind. He goes, let's look at this in the cultural context. Let's look at what John is actually saying. He's saying this as a warning. They're both kind of saying the same thing.
Right.
Their methods of saying it are very different. And I think... I don't know if one is necessarily better or worse, but one definitely looks to be better or worse.
Yeah. Because it's the, I think it's almost verges on, I'm trying to think of what the word would be, but it's like the cult kind of thing, you know, he's riling them up, isn't he? To get to the point of like, you know, I believe kind of thing. And from a UK perspective, from my perspective, that feels very alien to me that, you know, When I do see things or over there, and it's like I can't get my head around that because it's not something that I've seen. I'm sure it happens in the UK, you know, there were all sorts of imagination, but particularly where in my wheelhouse, there's nothing like that. And you know, and it's difficult to actually, you know, fathom that in my own head, which is great. What do you think to the use of, because you mentioned the obviously some of the scripture there, but it also said the one on the placard, that look unto me and be saved all ends of the earth, for I am God and there is none other, the Isaiah quote.
Yep.
What did you make to that being as their you know, their signpost?
You know, I like that. I think it's, in a way, I think it's almost foreshadowing the twist. Because when you look at the other church, when you look at Mackey's church, there's no like blatant in your face scripture in front of it. It's very much like this calm, traditional, I'm going to kind of lull you into my arms before I strangle you kind of thing, which you don't think about when you're watching it until the end and you see it in context. Likewise, I think you see the sign at the beginning and you're like, oh, well, they're just crazy people, but it's no, they just really believe that God will protect them.
Yeah.
And it's almost kind of foreshadowing that end with Enoch O'Connor and him kind of getting saved from those bites and then saving his daughter and all of that. And obviously he's led to do something that's wrong, right? He's led to go kill Mackey, or at least he feels that way.
Because that's another thing that's underlying this as well. Like you mentioned, kind of the lulling, the lulling kind of to sleep, something that Millennium did in The Curse of Frank Black.
Yeah.
Where you've got like the satanic or the demonic, you know, creature or person trying to like sort of use, and this is what something that the Reverend Mackey uses on the girl is that to lull her into thinking, well, this is right, you know, you should be looking after your dad in this perspective. You need to you know, give him the medicine that he needs, and God doesn't need to warrant, you know, you need to look after, make your own choices. Mm-hmm. And by making her own choices, she's going against her father's wishes, but sure. It's also being lulled into that by that kind of presence. And, you know, that in itself is really interesting. And Mulder kind of alludes to it during his conversation about tolerance, that, you know, yeah. They are so black and white in the Church of Signs and Wonders, but yet there's room for maneuver. There's room for thought. There's room for this, like, perspective of how do you work in the world, and you're allowed to do that with the other church. And I just find that really fascinating, especially the way the Mulder says, you know, tolerance is maybe it is a good way.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting too, Mulder's take on everything, because it kind of seems a little out of character. Mulder said in the past he's not really a religious person, you know. Yeah. He doesn't believe those sort of things. He believes in aliens, but he doesn't believe in God, you know. That's a little outlandish. And so him and Scully kind of have this back and forth about that throughout the series. And here, what's interesting is Scully is like, I didn't learn about this in catechism class, like, this isn't how it's supposed to be. And Mulder kind of takes their defense a little bit. And it's very interesting. And when he says something like, well, how different is this than transubstantiation, you know, which, for those who don't know what that means, it's basically when you take the Eucharist, when you take communion, it just means that the wine and the bread literally becomes the blood and the flesh of Jesus.
Yeah.
Is the idea. And that's something that isn't found in Scripture. Also, just like snake handling. And so It's kind of comparing these two things, neither of which are actually commands by God or things that are said in the Bible, but it's something that these respective churches have adapted for whatever reason in their congregations. And so I think that's a very interesting comparison, and Mulder kind of playing devil's advocate a little bit there. So
yeah, and especially with the way that Mulder actually works as well. You know, he's been, for the 7 seasons that we've seen him, a person who wants to believe, you know, that's his mantra. I want to believe. Yeah. Yeah, that's his whole thing. I know you mentioned season 5 where he loses that a little bit, but the fact that there is that, you know, that sacred truth that he's after, and will he ever attain it is another question, right? You know, completely entirely. But it, in some ways, it does, as you say, it does make you feel like, well, actually, it's something Mulder would actually latch onto rather than the religious aspect, which is more a spiritual thing, which he would outrightly sort of disregard, you know, in the past, you know, whether it be with Scully's sister or the episodes like Revelations, for example. He just wouldn't necessarily jump on board with that. And I do find that fascinating that that they've managed to fit that in, that Jeffrey Bell's managed to fit that into Mulder's character. What about the character of Iris? Because Iris is... We find it, and it's really interesting how they like feed her into this, that she's obviously the guardian protector of Gracie, and you know, when she starts to click into the, oh, there's something not quite right here, she's obviously like bumped off. But the scenes where she's obviously got the little the staple removers and things like that, which is obviously a snake thing. I it was quite funny because I was going, oh, that's quite a clever thing. And the first one I saw was like, that's really nice little, you know, little nod to go, right, okay, maybe nothing is what you seems, knowing the end of it. But then they actually make it quite overt later on, which I thought, because I thought, oh, that's going to be a nice little thing to talk about. I went, oh, no, it's fine. It's okay. But yeah, the very nature of Mackie obviously realizing, you know, that she didn't tell the police that his secret is still safe, and that she is cottoning on, he has to do something about it. It moves the plot along quite nicely, but it's also, you know, a nice introduction to, you know, kind of this, hang on a second, there's something not quite right here in regards to the full story of Gracie and the child, really.
I think what is really great about Iris too is it shows this idea that there really are genuinely good believing people in these congregations, even if their leaders are bad. Right. And I think that's a huge commentary on the church in general, where you have scandals where priests abuse kids or pastors sleep with people in the congregation and stuff like that happens. And I think seeing and being reminded of the fact that there are genuinely good people in each of these congregations. I mean, the whole reason later on that they bring Gracie back to the Signs and Wonders Church is actually to save her. It's not actually to harm her. And so you see this good in these people and this genuineness of their faith that I think we've seen in Scully throughout the show. And now we're seeing in these one-off characters who are kind of here for a time and then they're gone. I think that's really good. And I think it really is different than how O'Connor and how, what was the other guy's name? Mackie.
Yeah.
Are portrayed. And I think that was really good. I love also the stapler remover. I think that was so clever. And now I'm terrified of them. So I won't be using one again.
Just have a stapler remover just on your bedside. So you turn around and look and go, you know, that would easily get you.
Just start slowly overcoming the fear every morning. Yeah.
What about Scully then? Because it wouldn't be right not to talk about Scully and her religious beliefs. And, you know, throughout this episode, there's a few moments where she's tested and she's literally tested in this one as well. Yep. You know, she is put into danger again. And I know that would be a criticism, but, you know, in the nature of the story, it's interesting. And we never get to find an answer, which I also find really nice as well, that the fact that, you know, O'Connor does say to Mulder at some point, you know, that we'll never know, you know, she might have passed that test kind of thing. So Scully throughout this, I mean, there's moments as well where she's like, so I'll go around the back. and obviously Mulder and Scully actually in with the snakes. And, you know, Mulder says something along the lines of like, well, yeah, just in case I'm not righteous, can you just please remove it? Which I thought was quite nice. But Scully herself, as I say, throughout this episode, you know, she's tested herself. And I think that's interesting. Some of the things that she says over this is, I think, is really important to the episode.
Well, she really holds her own. She always does.
Yeah.
But when it comes to matters of faith and matters of religion, she is always very practical and very open-minded in a way. I mean, she's closed-minded in some ways. Like, she's like snake handling. I don't want that. That's weird. But she's very open-minded from the standpoint that she understands people's faith and what drives them. And so when she is tested, when her hand is put in the cage with the snake, it doesn't bite her. Like, nothing happens. She's saved, quote unquote, before anything does, even though it had more than enough time. It doesn't actually bite her. And I think at the end, when she comes to say Mulder, who has bitten multiple times.
Yeah.
Mackie's gone. He's just gone. And the last snake leaves. It doesn't want anything to do with her. And I think it's this idea that Scully is a righteous person.
Right.
But Scully does have this genuine faith that has actually protected her, whether she understands or believes that or not. And I think that's seen throughout the episode. And so even when it looks like she's being attacked and it looks like she's in danger, she's not. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting when it comes to the end and you realize that. Because Mulder does get bit. Mulder gets bit a lot. Yeah. Mulder is not a righteous person, and he's aware of that at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah.
But Scully is never once attacked in that way by any snake. And I think that's really telling. I think that's really a really interesting way to show her true faith ultimately throughout. So,
yeah, no, it's really interesting you should say that. It's something I hadn't really thought about too much with the dichotomy between the two of them. So that's really interesting. Yeah. And I mean, the back end of that scene, though, when she's at the door, that has early season, you know, X-Files vibes to it, that, you know, she doesn't see, you know, the snakes. She only sees that one last one leaving and, you know, the door's locked and she can't get into the door and things like that. So, and then, you know, things slamming behind them. So we do have some classic X-Files stuff. And I quite like that. I quite like it to come back into season 7 because it is something we've not maybe seen, you know, for a while, which I think is really nice. So, yeah, so moving back to O'Connor, because Scully is put into that danger by O'Connor, it's man that does that, you know, not Satan as such. Even to the point Gracie says that as well. Says, no, he didn't do this. No, he didn't do this. This is Satan works, not man's.
Yep.
And we have this, like, O'Connor being portrayed in this particular way because we need to keep the ambiguity of the episode going. Even to the point where Grace is asking for a dad later in the episode and she's saying, daddy, you know, where is he? No, it's not, you know, thing. And so, and you get quite a few of those moments where you can take it both ways, or it doesn't quite push it to the point of that. But the fact that, as I say, that using, you know, it's not man's work, and that use that Gracie does, Gracie has that strong belief that she's grown up in within that church and is trying to escape that church. I mean, what do you make to that whole concept of one, that even though she's escaped the church, she still believes in her father and she still believes and has that belief. And they even mention it in the episode as well about, mm-hmm. you know, things that you're born into or grow into when you're young, and you can't always shake that. You know, if you are trying to get all that, what do you make to that whole, that kind of idea for the show to actually push? Because it's asking a really pertinent question about how people are formed really in their younger lives.
Yeah. Well, I think a way to sum that up really nicely is there's a verse in the book of Proverbs that says, train up a child in the way they should go and they will not depart from it. Right. And I think there's something to be said about that. Absolutely. It's this idea of what is nature and what is nurture. And I think this episode is very heavy on the nurture. I think Gracie's whole arc is this idea that she doesn't want to be associated with some of the craziness from her father's church, but she really does believe. She really still has faith in God.
Yeah,
she just doesn't want some of this crazy, almost cult-like, like you were saying, stuff. And that's why she leaves and goes to another church. And that's the thing. She goes to another church. She doesn't leave the faith entirely. She leaves and moves congregations. And it's because she still has this faith. She believes this because whether or not it's because of how she was raised is a moot point, because at the end of the day, she doesn't depart from this belief. And when her father saves her later on, I don't know. I don't know if she goes back to that church again or not, but I know that she understands what happened and is grateful for that. And so it's very interesting. It's a very interesting idea about leaving your parents and leaving things you grew up with. And I think we see that a lot with people with their political ideologies. Some people go very far away from their parents in terms of their politics, and some people stay very close to home.
Yeah.
And I think religion can be very similar. I think a lot of things can be very similar.
Yeah.
And so I think that's just really interesting.
And also, there's things within this episode as well, but just, as I say, how the choice of words are really important in the episode to keep that ambiguity. So when Scully's on the in the Church of Signs and Wonders, there's a bit where it says that we pray for the souls of our brothers and sisters, some of us lost to us, and you know, it obviously indicates the mother, you know, the, and obviously the Gracie and Gracie's boyfriend. So using particular words have ambiguous meanings, you know, at the time when you don't realize it, I thought was quite effective. And it then leads us to the, you know, the questions over, you know, O'Connor's history with his, you know, with their mother, and, you know, and all that as well. You know, and it adds that layer of like, can we trust this guy? Which we're obviously led to down the road of, we don't want to trust him, which I find, which is great.
Well, and that's shoved down your throat when it comes out, the information comes out that, well, he actually impregnated his daughter and not the boyfriend, you know, and it's this idea that she was running away from that. And we want to believe that because this guy feels insane.
Yeah.
He looks insane. He acts insane. I mean, he has people falling down and passing out in the middle of his church services. That's weird. And we don't like that. And it's uncomfortable. And Mackie is comfortable.
Yeah.
And he is not. And we almost want it, kind of like Mulder, we almost want to believe that is true, as horrible as it is, because the alternative is kind of scarier.
And that's the thing, isn't it? Because it's also playing to your prejudices, you know, in some, because obviously it's going, oh, the father of a church, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and it's playing to that, you know, what you would think, oh, right, okay, well, this is evil. This is not nice. This is, you know, incestuous. It's all these things. And it's playing on, you know, serpents being fear. You've got, you know, a lot of things in here which are kind of quite horrible to think about. And as I say, the fact that there's this incestuous moment and, you know, this question mark over that and the infertility, which in itself was quite funny in some ways. And I mean this just purely on the way that Mulder finds out, because I think it's really important to say, like, you know, at least Mulder's like going, I think he said something like infertility or something like that. And the way that Mulder says, if I'm reading this right, I'm like, Mulder, you're a really intelligent bloke. You know, I know it's designed for the audience and things like that, but I'm just like, but I do like that Mulder finds it and he refers to Scully, but it's just like, okay, all right, I get it. You know, you're trying to do it a slightly different way, and I appreciate that, but it does land a bit flat for me. Yeah, so what do you make to this father kind of, you know, is the father of the child kind of aspect, and what happens during the actual kidnapping abduction scene?
You know, the sad thing is that happens.
Right.
And you see that especially in backwoods Appalachia type places. And that's kind of what Home is about, right? That's what that entire episode is about. And because we've seen Home, and because we know, oh, this is something that happens in these backwoods places, we automatically assume the worst of people, especially people who live there, rather than anything else. And again, we're hearing this from a quote unquote man of God, somebody who is supposed to be telling the truth, somebody who is supposed to be here to love and here to serve and to protect. And so when we hear this from him, we're like, okay, we believe that, because Gracie wouldn't say that because she's ashamed.
Yeah.
Right. That's the implication. And he would, because he wants to tell the truth and help the authorities. We've seen that since the moment they were introduced at the beginning of the episode. And so we buy it. And the whole abduction thing. Well, first of all, I think we need to backtrack just a little bit after O'Connor is bit by all the snakes in the jail cell. He is miraculously healed.
Yes.
And we see all of the pus and all of the poison drain out of his body. And it's very weird looking. It's very unsettling. And he grabs his daughter and you're afraid, because we still believe that he is the father of this child.
Yeah.
He wants her back so that he has an heir to his spiritual empire or whatever it is, you know, and when we find out that that's not true. And again, even that whole scene where they induce her into labor or force her into labor and all of that.
Yeah.
And it's very cultish. It feels very cultish. It's very scary. There's candlelight and it's dark. And honestly, it's a little traumatizing to watch.
Yeah.
Because it feels almost rapey in a lot of ways. And obviously something's coming out instead of going in, but still that's how it feels. And, and you're very unsettled. Like when I rewatched, I was like, this is horrible. Like I almost don't want, I have to turn away almost. It's that kind of disturbing. Yeah. At least it felt that way to me. And when the snakes come out, you still don't know what to make of it, because you're wondering, did he do that? Like, how did he put the snakes in there? That doesn't make sense. Only to find out later that isn't the case, and that he actually saved her. And you find that out from Gracie later, who's finally speaking up for herself and telling the truth instead of letting other people speak for her the whole episode.
Yeah.
And so for her, I think that's a huge moment. But I don't know. What did you think about all that?
I thought you talked about Dejan de Valette is very ritualistic, and, you know, whether or not that, you know, it calls back to that, as you say, it's more of a horror trope. It's more of a, you know, it's all dark. They've got candlelight. They've got, you know, the body horror moments. And, and what jumped out at me on this watch is, you know, only next season we're going to get the episode Roadrunners, which is the Jesus slug. So we've got that to come. And that has the same sort of thing, the same body horror. I know it's her Scully's back in that occasion. You know, but this is obviously a pregnant lady who's got like that body happening. So the body horror aspect of it is really effective. And, you know, I'm not a person that gets scared easily. I'm not, I don't generally kind of react in that way. I think probably the worst I've probably felt was during, The Thing, you know, 1982, the Thing is probably as scary as I've been, but I'm used to body horror. It doesn't really concern me that much. But having said that, this one definitely had that darkness, which I wasn't expecting. I kind of remembered the snakes. I kind of remembered the kind of the congregation and the way that he was quite, you know, full on and things like that. But I didn't remember those scenes. So so in my view, it was like, oh, it is quite dark. It is quite, you know, body horror-esque and, you know, horror movie-esque. And yeah, I think it does a really good job of like creating a visceral reaction in people. So
yeah,
I thought it was really, really interesting because it's not only that, it's that lighter and dark again as well. The fact that you've got the church, the other church is all like brightly white painted and, you know, and then as I say, you go into this candlelight, you know, a ritual. Everyone's watching and you've got that unease of there's people just watching this, you know, and actually chanting and things like that. And it doesn't look good.
It feels like something more out of like Midsommar or something like that, where it's just terrifying and these people are just watching and not batting an eye. And it's really disturbing.
Yeah, really, really disturbing.
I was going to say another quick tidbit that I think is really interesting is that Michael Childers, the guy who played Reverend O'Connor, actually is the son of a snake handling preacher.
Yeah.
And so when you see him handling these snakes and you see him like becoming this person, this reverend, it's very interesting knowing that background because you kind of wonder, is he trying to be his father? Like, is this how his father was? Is this how he's trying to be? And that's just an interesting thing to add to the episode that has nothing to do with the actual episode itself, but I think it really lends to his performance and he really seals it throughout. He's a very solid performer in this episode. So
I mean, what about Reverend Mackey then? I mean, the one thing I would say, I mean, I quite like ambiguity, you know, at the end of episodes.
Sure.
I think there's a comment later on the mailbag, which says, you know, it's got Sanguinarium kind of vibes to it, that he's just going around all these different churches. I mean, what is the end, you know, what is the end result for this? Why is he doing this? What is his ultimate goal? And that's not something we really pick up on, but is there anything you want to, like, talk about on that?
Well, I think the obvious answer, other than we don't know, is that if he is an embodiment of Satan, if he is a demon, if he is one of those minions, then his whole motivation would be to tear down what God created, right? And so if he wants to keep going to different churches and destroy them from the inside, that seems to be what the goal would be. I don't know if there's anything else other than that. I mean, Satan is known as a tempter, and Scully mentions it in the episode. You know, the reason serpents are associated with the devil is because of the Garden of Eden and the temptation of Eve and all of that, and how Satan is referred to as being like a serpent or a dragon or any kind of reptilian creature. And that just kind of seems to be the obvious answer, that it would be to just keep tearing down the church.
And what I've alluded to this a little bit, and I apologize for those people who are getting sick of me hearing this word, millennium. but, you know, we've had the sixth extinction, you know, the last temptation of Christ, effectively. There's a special Patreon episode on that, which I was happy to get involved in. You've got Lights of Orison. You've got this episode. You've got millennium. Mm-hmm. It seems that religion seems to be a key feature in this section. Now, whether or not that is because of a hangover, because Millennium's now finished, but there does seem to be more religious episodes in this, or religious themed type episodes in this first half of season 7 than there has been for quite some time, really. And I find that fascinating that they have kind of lost Millennium at this point, but there is still this kind of religious concept. And it's and then taking it one step further, that we really flip into the spiritual realm in the next couple of episodes with Zion's Light and Closure. I mean, what do you make to that? What do you make to the the kind of, you know, it's pushing the religious aspects a bit more than what they may have done in the past couple of seasons?
Well, I can take it one of two ways. I think the first way, and the way that I guess maybe choose to take it, is that it is this Millennium Hangover, and it is this idea that maybe these are episodes that the writers were workshopping as to be a part of the next season of Millennium that they then had to scrap and were able to use on the X-Files. Like, that's the obvious kind of fun behind the scenes answer, especially for us who love that show and are passionate about that show. And again, we talked about this earlier, and again, I'm sorry if you guys are sick of us talking about it, but this is what you get when you get two people who've done a lot of the Time Is Now podcasts together again. Signs and Wonders feels like a Millennium episode.
Yeah.
So much more so than Millennium does earlier this season of The X-Files.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of episodes this season that kind of feel that way, and that's really cool and really interesting. But it doesn't feel totally X-Files, and they shifted enough that it does feel X-Files. I think this idea that, you know, they set up very on, like in the first few episodes of the X-Files, that Scully is Catholic and she does have this faith. I think that really lends itself, and they were able to kind of make this feel more X-Files-ish because you have that in, which I guess brings me to the second way you could take it is season seven in a lot of ways very much feels like this is our last season.
Yeah.
This is how we're ending. I mean, even the finale goes back directly to the pilot, and you feel like this should be the natural bookend of the show. And I remember when I was on my first X-Cast episode, which was a roundtable, all about jumping the shark. And I think my answer to when did X-Files jump the shark, I think it actually was after season seven. I think the season seven finale might have been my answer to that question, because season seven very much feels like the end.
Yeah.
And in so saying that, you have the conspiracy with the syndicate wrapping up. You have Mulder getting closure pretty soon with Samantha in an episode that is aptly titled that. you have things like Frank Black and his arc even coming to a close, which is a little thing that has nothing to do with the X-Files, but it's because they were like, maybe we're not doing it again. You have David Duchovny, who's wanting to leave.
Yeah.
And they very much structure the season like it's the end. And so this episode, I think, is just another glimpse into, and maybe some of these other overtly religious episodes are a glimpse into Scully coming to terms with her faith. And really seeing it for how it is. And she's been so scientifically minded, especially in the sixth extinction episodes.
Yeah.
And even earlier on in the series, past few seasons, even so scientifically minded that I think there's times where we kind of lose the fact that, remember, she is Catholic. She does have this faith.
Yeah.
And I think this is kind of bringing that back full circle and bringing her to that natural conclusion of, yeah, this is what I believe. And so that's kind of how I take it, if that makes sense. That was a little long winded, but
no, it's all right. No, I mean, that's perfectly acceptable, because as I say, you know, we feel, my perception is this time slowing down, which seems to happen a lot in the episodes I've done so far. It'd be interesting once I get to watch some of the other, because I'll be watching along, and I think they're up to Millennium now, so I'll be catching up with the podcasters as we go along with the episodes I've not been on, and obviously I've been watching the ones that I've been on as well, so it's going to be interesting with that. You've got like Sign and Sight and Closure, which, you know, time slows down in the episode. So it's going to be, so there's various different things. It does feel like it's coming to the end, and you know, the fascination that Darren said with zombies, like we said at the top of the hour as well. Yep. But just one thing to say then before we go into the mailbag, and it gets touched upon in the mailbag as well, is like the only like critique I would have at the very end is the CGI.
Sure. It's a little dated.
It's a little bit dated, which is unfortunate. But yeah, I mentioned the mailbag, so I'll put a call out onto the Facebook Basement group, and we shall go and have a look at that now. Okay, so we're in the mailbag. So Michael Little says, the only Jeff Bell episode worth watching. Kim Manners does a fantastic job with great atmosphere and creep factor. Too bad David and Julian seem bored out of their minds. So that's obviously one of the comments alluding to his directing. But Kim Manners, fantastic director. You know, he's obviously since departed us. But I think the cutting scenes between, you mentioned about the congregation and you know, the kind of the way that O'Connor is conducting his, you know, his snake rattling and things. I think the way that keeps cutting between the two, I think is yeah. really, really good. I think that's a really tight part of the episode. And going back to the top of the hour, how dark and, you know, the way that he does the that scene. So I think Kim Manis does a fantastic job, and it would be difficult to think about another person doing that kind of episode as well.
I agree. And it kind of reminds me about of Die Hand, Die Verletz again as well, yeah. with the cuts between Paddock and the snake going down the stairs to eat the yeah. eat the cult member and her and the girl who cuts herself and just all that just that tight cutting back yeah. and forth. It reminds me a lot of that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot to think. I didn't put those two together. maybe should have, but yeah, there's a lot to compare between those two. That'd be fascinating. Chris Knowles has been on as well. Michael Childers' virtuoso performance redeems what could have been a tired blend of Miracle Man and Sanguinarium. Some very sour notes, though. Scully's crack about flying saucers after taking rubbins from one is just bad story editing, and the ending sucks. She does mention, I watched this, and I watched this after seeing Chris Knowles' comment.
Yeah.
And she does mention the flying saucers thing. I didn't necessarily take that away. I thought it was okay. But having said that, I get his point. You know, she was literally yeah. 5 or 6 episodes ago taking a pencil and paper and rubbing loads of like symbols and, you know, scripture and all kinds from that's that from true. An alien spaceship. So, I mean, what do you make as someone of religion to that monolithic type thing in Sixth Extinction? What did you make to it?
It's very interesting. I don't know how to take it. It just seems like it was never really paid off. So I don't know if
right.
I would say that it was worth doing. It actually is something that kind of bothers me
right.
about season 7, because it's this idea that, oh, well, religion originates with aliens, and that's kind of weird, and I don't like that. But
right.
beyond just that, I think there's this idea that it just doesn't really pay off.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like nothing really comes of it, and it doesn't really shake Scully's faith all that much, especially when it comes to like this episode and other episodes later on. And I don't know, it just doesn't, it seems inconsequential.
Yeah. It seems focused on Mulder's side of stuff rather than Scully's, doesn't it?
That yes.
Scully's there and she's doing something. She's doing the science and she's seeing the things written on that ship.
Yep.
But then it's more about Mulder. So yeah, so I can see what Chris Knowles is saying with that comment, because she does say about flying saucers, but I think for the episode itself, it's pointing more towards what you were saying before about Mulder's kind of quest and his way that he views wanting to believe rather than actually yes. being so, you know, a bit more nuanced, I think is probably the best word to put in.
Sure.
Adam Silver, agree with the above. Enjoy this one fairly well. Not great, but solid. I think we pretty much alluded to that. Except the very bad CGI ending. We definitely agree with that.
Yep.
Ronald Wilson says to Adam as well, I forgive the CGI. Everyone was still trying to figure out at the time. It was miraculous that the Leonard Betts effect just 3 years earlier turned out as good as it did. He then goes on to say his own comment. I don't rank this very high because it is sometimes rather simplistic or tries to be too flashy, stroke shocking to be taken seriously. Once again, X-Files takes a rare poke at religion and comes out of it half-heartedly. However, it is also very confounding and confusing. One of the most mixed messages that any X-Files episode has ever been stuck with. At least that's how it feels to this liberal Christian. It will be interesting to hear how you disentangle this writhing mass of serpentine contradictions. It strikes me, like a cobra, that this could have become a second crossover with Millennium, only better. So how, as a person of religion, then, how do you view it? Because Ronald's saying he's obviously a liberal Christian. How do you personally view this episode from that perspective?
Sure. And I full disclosure, I don't know if I'd identify as either a conservative or liberal Christian.
Okay.
I would just consider myself a Christian. I try politically to be very in the middle as much as possible. So coming at it just strictly through a biblical lens, I think it's really interesting. I think it is hard. It does have a lot of mixed. Can I say that word right? It does have a lot of mixed messages in it. It's at least on the surface. I think ultimately there's two things that we need to take away with it. One, I think we need to take away that when it comes to religion, how people present themselves and how they actually are, or how true their faith actually is, can be two very different things. You know, nowadays you have celebrity pastors who go on famous talk shows and go around the country and speak to millions of people, but then they're flying around on their own private jets, and they're not, you know, giving or actively serving or helping people. And you know, Jesus says that he who desires to be greatest among you has to become a servant. And so, you see these people of religious ability and power who are not themselves servants.
Yeah.
And that feels very much like our Satan character in this episode, whereas you have people who are actively willing to serve others, even if it doesn't always sit right with everybody, like O'Connor's character. And and obviously there's some real weird things like snake handling. I don't think is a biblical thing. I don't think that's necessarily something people should be practicing. I think that's very dangerous, borderline negligent. But it is very interesting. And it's this idea that do you really trust God, or do you just trust your own experience, I think, in some ways. And I think that's also an interesting idea that comes out of this episode. So I don't know. I think it is mixed in a sense. I think that it's hard to watch somebody like O'Connor, especially if you come from a very different way of practicing Christianity. You know, I grew up with my mom going to charismatic meetings and stuff like that, and not snake handling exactly, but some of the more like loud preachers who kind of walk around and touch people and they fall down sort of thing. I grew up seeing that, but I also grew up very much in a more traditional church like the other church. And so I kind of see both sides in some ways. So maybe I'm not the best person to analyze that, or maybe I am. I don't know. But
well, I think it comes down to, as you say, experience, isn't it? Because I can't make a comment on that because, as you know, I'm not religious at all. And I'm viewing it through a lens of it's interesting how they've, you know, used that. The way I view it is, like I said during this episode, is that it's talking about the nuance between, you know, having someone being really overt with somebody and clear and concise, but looking, you know, like they're not the way they should be. And then having someone who's, as you say, preaching to that point of, you know, being the traditionalist and looking at it, and also the fact that things can creep in because there's nuance there. There's people that might not even go to church for the sake of going to church. They just go to church because they're told to on a Sunday afternoon, for example. You know, that you know, the wealthy, we feel it's a gated community. That's something we need to do. And, you know, some aspects can slide in via that way. So I think it is an interesting discussion. And as I say, coming from my perspective, it's a lot different. But it is good. And one of the reasons why I thought of you for this episode was for that reason, you know, just to get that kind of point of view, as always.
Well, hopefully I lived up to the hype. Dang. I think also, too, you can look at this from a very non-religious point of view and still understand the message. And I guess what I mean by that is I think there's people just in everyday life who act a certain way who are snakes, and they don't act like snakes, but they are. And then you have people who act, I don't know, sometimes terribly, sometimes oddly, sometimes uncomfortably, but genuinely want the best for you. That's a real thing in real life with real people. And I think maybe that is the most important message that you should take from an episode like this.
Excellent. If there wasn't more mailbag questions, I would have ended it there. but we've got some more, so let's go and do this. Andrew Levitt, a thrilling episode in theory, but an average one in execution, mostly because of David and Gillian's boredom, like much of season 7. There are some creepy thrills to be had. Snakes are pretty scary, and the exploration of different styles of belief had potential. but the way it plays out feels lukewarm, like O'Connor's perspective on regular Christianity. 5 out of 10.
Interesting.
Tony Black, he said, "This is a very quiet gem for me, almost entirely forgotten and hugely underrated, perhaps because it feels either like a Millennium episode or a throwback to the earlier season 2 or season 3 days of The X-Files. A solid, smoky, standalone riven with religious intensity. Eccentric performances in which Mulder and Scully do little but bystand. In this case, that's okay, because what we get is a true potboiler with easily one of the most deliberate gonzo final moments in the series run, but one that has stayed with me for decades. Rediscover this is my advice." I think I alluded to before, I think the, and you've mentioned it since as well, that by slightly retooling this, they've made it a Mulder and Scully one. And I can see it being a Millennium episode. I can see this being Frank just sitting and as a bystander. Yep. I don't really have that criticism with shows. I mean, I don't know if it's because I love likes of The Outer Limits and Twilight Zone and stuff like that as well. But, you know, I don't always think that you necessarily need to have, I mean, I wouldn't want it every episode, but you need to have Mulder and Scully actually affecting it. I had this discussion a little bit in Rush, where they don't really do anything. Mm-hmm. They're just there. I think there was a criticism of season 6 being a bit like The Outer Limits and Twilight Zone. So there is this criticism of it, but they do feel like they've been plonked into something that was going to happen anyway. But I don't always think that's a bad criticism, to be fair. Sometimes I think the show warrants it. And when you're dealing with evil, it's something that's unreachable and untenable. So the fact that they can't really affect it, and like what you said with Scully, on that end scene, I think is effective for that reason. And I think that, you know, it is, you know, at the end of Dehan de Valette's, you know, all they get is, you know, the chalkboard at the end. So there is moments when you have to like look at the higher powers involved and go, I can't really touch this. So I don't know if that's how you feel for this particular episode.
No, I 100% agree with you, and I think that's actually something Millennium did really well. Frank did not always have to be the center of every story, and some of the stronger episodes, even like Somehow Satan Got Behind Me, he's not. He's not the center of the story. He is a bystander, even a lot more so than Mulder and Scully are in this episode, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I wouldn't want that every episode either. Agree with that, because there's a reason we keep coming back to shows like this. We want to see our favorite characters in new situations, and we want to see them grow and develop and change. But I don't think them not having a whole lot to do this episode, which I don't even think is entirely true, at least for Scully's point of view. But I don't think that's a bad thing. I actually think the performances of our reverends really lend well to this episode and really help it along in a way that I don't think Mulder and Scully could.
Yeah. Final comment of the night, which is Liam Shane Goglin. Sorry if I mispronounced his surname there. Stark iconography playing with the time-honored horror tropes and themes. The 7th season returning again to its preoccupation with the nature of fear and what constitutes the slavish devotion to a specific belief system of ideology. Tying in with the upcoming two-parter that will exercise one of the main protagonists of the most Campbellian part of his quest. The episode points to a notion that this is only by confronting these fears and conquering them can we hope to grow and evolve. A timely episode, if not a timeless one. So that's an interesting comment about reaching, you know, considering your fears and reaching out and putting that staple remover next to your bed, Michael, so I remember to do that.
Well, I guess that's what I'm doing. Putting it right on top of my Bible. That's what I'll do.
Okay, so any comments to make on that, or any final comments for the episode itself before we wrap up for this week's episode?
You know, I went into Signs and Wonders thinking that this was just going to be another X-File with just a little bit of religious undertones. But I was very pleasantly surprised upon rewatching it that this is a really solid episode. You know, this is an episode that feels very much like Millennium, which is also one of our favorite shows.
Yeah.
And a show that I am very passionate about and that kind of ended before its time. And to see themes and ideas and even maybe possibly storylines from that show show up on The X-Files, which is another one of my all-time favorite shows, I'm here for it. I'm very happy to have watched it again, and I'm really thankful that you had me back on.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. You know, it's been good to speak to you again, as always. And, you know, we don't have Millennium anymore, but we have plenty of X-Files still to go yet.
Well, I will be around.
So other than that then, where can people find you online? What have you been up to in the, you know, the bygone years? Because the fourth Patreon roundtable would have been years ago. So what have you been up to? Yeah. And where can people find you online?
I actually co-host a Terminator podcast with a good friend of mine. It's called No Fate, a Terminator podcast. And we just finished covering all 6 of the Terminator films. So some of them are 2-part episodes. Some of them are extended episodes. It usually goes between 25 to 40 minutes a pop. And we love that. We're actually just about to get into our coverage of Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles, which is a very short-lived Terminator series that we absolutely adore. And so if you're interested in that, if you haven't watched it, it's on Hulu, so you can watch it with us now. Definitely look us up. We have a website, nofatepodcast.com. Actually, let me double check that. I think that's the address. Yeah. Our website is nofatepodcast.com. And from there, you can find our Twitter account, which is @nofatepod. We also kind of frequent some Terminator fan groups or Sarah Connor Chronicles fan groups on Facebook every once in a while. So you can find us on some of that as well.
Excellent. Okay, so you can find me in all the usual places on Twitter at @rmuldrake. It's RMULDRAKE. Currently looking through series 5 of Red Dwarf on the Red Dwarf podcast, Shipwrecked and Comatose. And you can find that at Red Dwarf Pod. I've been popping up. I need to pay a bit more attention to this, but I've been popping up on the Make It So podcast, a podcast I co-host with Luke Winch about Star Trek Picard as well. And you can find that at Jean-Luc Podard. So those are the best places to find me. And as always, if you do want to get into Millennium, please do. as much as I keep saying it, you know, people might start watching it if I keep going on about it enough.
Well, it's hard when it's not on anything. You have to go get you have to find the DVDs, which is well worth it.
Yeah, which are out of print. I've got 2 copies of them and other versions, which I have in my personal collection. But yeah, you can find that at The Time Is Now Pod. But yeah, thank you very much, Michael, for joining us. Hopefully you'll be back on sometime in the near future. So thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kurt. I appreciate it.
No problem. And until next time, remember, everyone, trust no one.
Elsewhere, and We Made This. The Movie Palace Podcast.
So I normally just ask people, Robert, you know, their general thoughts on Alfred Hitchcock. Yeah, what are your thoughts and feelings about Hitchcock?
Well, you know, it's funny because we had discussed, you know, how this talk was going to go today. And I kept thinking, yeah, why have I been so interested in Hitchcock? Generally speaking, I'm more interested in the less technical filmmakers. And Hitchcock is such a technical filmmaker.
We dig music.
How come you always refer to Jonathan Donahue as Donahue and you always refer to PJ Harvey as Polly?
Because she's overly familiar with Polly.
Right. Yeah, that could do it.
It freaks me out as well. Like, I don't call any of the singers in bands by their first name because I don't know them. I'm not like, oh, there's my mate Johannes from Cult of Luna. No. It's Johannes from Cult of Luna or Johannes Person. Or, oh my God, it's Johannes Person from Cult of Luna sometime. Like, that's how I refer to him.
So you're saying that it's Sit Down Mr. Ulrich instead of Sit Down Lars?
I think it depends how much I take an artist to heart, you know, and Polly is very, very dear to me. So.
Well, she thinks you're a prick because you don't like Ministry.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
But you're not really quite sure what's happened there. It might put you off seeing the next one.
That does make a lot of sense, actually. Good point. All right.
Carl can always give us the information in a way we can make it understand. Me and Mark just go, bleh, 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 bleh.
I occasionally sound vaguely intelligent when I try very hard. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I occasionally
I also whine about gay shit. I'm multifaceted.
Okay. Anyway, moving on.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast Pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.